Thank you for coming. Unlike some people, I'm always happy with a smaller audience. The less the better in my book. So I appreciate you all coming after a late lunch. So let me just get going here, and we'll talk about this subject. And so when I talk about this subject, there's a sort of purpose involved, as there is with a lot of what I see other than the film. You know, I never expected I would be Mr. Homeschool Apologist, and I'm not really. I'm actually Mr. Anti-Public School, which I prefer. I kind of think I like the negative aspect of it. And part of that is being equipping people and helping people realize that we have an ideological battle, and the way they need to be equipped is not just to watch our film and be inspired and all the rest of it, but the other information that they can use for leverage with other people. Now, what in the film I talk about, or when I've been talking in these other seminars, we talk about the different responsibilities, the different ways that we work with people to try and persuade them. In this case, it's history. And history doesn't work with everybody. You know, some people respond negatively to history. You know, you talk to people about the Constitution and the beliefs of the founding fathers, and they honestly don't care what you're going to say to them. They're interested in maybe what's going on right now. So that's sort of a youth-oriented culture and kind of everything. Well, it's only relevant if it's happening right now. So history is not very relevant to them. And so we don't have a lot of leverage. But the other people do. Other people really do care about this. And if you remember, the people that do often are Christians who do talk about the Constitution, who do talk about, are concerned what happened in the 1700s and the 1800s. And they're actually the people that we're trying to reach. Because a lot of what we do is reach out to people that are actually closer to us but have one problem. And the one problem is they're using the public school system and they're Christian. And they shouldn't be using the public school system. So actually, I think there's some success with this argument, the historical argument. Now, in our film, we have the big yellow bus which drives us around the country. In production, we don't mention the film, but in production, we called it the bus of reprobates because it was our idea was this bus was to be filled with all the people that opposed. There were, you know, wicked men who opposed Christ. And so that's how they qualified to jump on this bus. And every one of them stood up to that angle that we were looking for, is that they were all unbelievers, but not just unbelievers and bad people, people who are militantly anti-Christian in their beliefs. This is the full list, and you'll probably recognize some of them there, but all of them certainly had a bad attitude. Maybe Obama would be the only one there who would profess faith, as far as I can tell, looking at them. Here's a little clip, actually.
Be successful. It had to be virtuous. And there was no way that you could have a virtuous republic without training in the principles of religion, specifically in the principles of Christianity.
So in early America, our founders had a biblical outlook that included an education that was grounded in the Word of God. The Puritans required a common school. The goal was to have a literate populace for the purpose of understanding Scripture.
Now, over time, those commitments began to change, and so the convictions about the necessity of Christianity and Christian education was replaced with the idea of a more generic, theistic education.
The same year the New England Primer was published, another book appeared, one that would radically transform educational philosophy for generations. That book was called Essay Concerning Human Understanding by John Locke. John Locke's philosophy presented the idea that the human mind at birth is a tabula rasa, a blank slate. This was a complete rejection of the doctrine of original sin, one of the notable separating points between Christian education and the humanistic public school system. America's public schools got it wrong at this fundamental level, the very nature of the child.
It's quite remarkable that we have allowed this particular educational philosophy to dominate America for so long, when the early history of the country indicated that it was a family responsibility, a church responsibility, not the responsibility of the civil government to educate the nation's children. If you go back in history, you'll see that the government's involvement in education was very minimal.
During America's history, homeschooling was never considered alternative education. In fact, for many notable Americans, it was their primary means of education. Many remarkable leaders were raised as either partially or completely schooled at home. During the 18th century, Enlightenment philosophy began to take hold in America. the popularity and influence of anti-Christian Enlightenment thinkers like Jean-Jacques Rousseau of France cast a lasting shadow across the colonies that would undermine the liberty Americans enjoyed at the end of the 18th century. As we moved into the 1800s, the specter of mass public education would soon appear on the horizon. All the clues were leading me to Boston, the birthplace of compulsory education in America.
Okay, so in the film there, that's a clip, we're making a case for the relevance of history, and we're going way back to 1600s, right through to now, so transition from biblical outlook to the Enlightenment to where we are right now, because the point we're trying to leverage there is a lot of people, you know, things get bad in their mind when Obama took office. That's like what you would expect from the average Republican, because there's political leverage with that argument. Or things get bad for a lot of people in the 50s and 60s if they're just pure moralists, and that's their primary concern. Our concern is their real philosophy and beliefs, the presuppositions of these individuals, and so we look back much further. And I think that's the most truthful way to be. What were the priorities of these people? When we look into them, what they believe, and it's not hard to find out what they believe. They were published, they wrote lots of books, and they're easy people to track. So 1800s, not that long ago. Someone like Robert Owen's a pretty interesting guy to track. Robert Owen was very open about his unbelief, and he has had huge problems with religion. He was from New Lanark, and we'll show you the clip in a minute. And we're just talking to a friend over here about New Harmony, Indiana. I don't know if you've ever been to New Harmony, Indiana. It's kind of an interesting place. And it's kind of a weird cult-like place. That's how it was established, but it's retained the kind of following of groups that have gone there, usually people from the left and collectivists of some sort. New Lanark is interesting because, you know, this is right in the heart of, Covenanter country, and this is the time Industrial Revolution model started to dominate the cultural and political landscape. And so Robert Owen, who became very wealthy by buying these mills and modernizing and converting them, but also bringing in a program. So he was really was an industrialist. And so you have to understand that's part of the process. These were guys with real vision, but their vision was skewed. They were kind of like the Steve Jobs. You know, you get someone like Steve Jobs or Bill Gates, and Bill Gates is a good example because he has all that wealth and money and power and has that influence in something, technology, which can be used for good, but he has, you know, a skewed worldview, which damages certainly all the ways he uses his money. Robert Owen was one of these guys that, For some reason, God's providence allows to come up and have this huge influence from his perspective. And New Lanark was where it was. Sadly, with the story of Robert Owen is that his father-in-law, David Dale, who owned the mine initially, and Robert Owen eventually owned it, was a believer and, you know, a real strong believer, reformed guy, in fact. And Robert Owen married his daughter. And, you know, so it's kind of there's kind of a sad story, which I don't know the full story. I haven't looked into the details of that. But I do know a bit about Robert Owen in terms of his worldview. And he became very popular in America, the New Harmony thing, but not just there. He published his works, which got into the hands of many of the influential people around the country. And so he was well known of. And he skewed away from his atheism and his later life into spiritualism, which is another, you know, obviously heretical group, and ended up with no money at the end of his life. And so, this was his vision, but it obviously had a big impact. I have a clip on Robert Owen.
Socialism was an ideology in this country as early as the 1820s, and it was brought to this country by Robert Owen, who believed that the cause of all of our problems was religion, and that children could be educated in such a way, without religion, to become anything you wanted. So he came to this country and he created the first secular communist colony in America called New Harmony, Indiana. And he thought that he could reform the universe by getting rid of religion. The best way to do that is to educate children without religion, so that they would create this new communist utopia in which everybody was equal.
I'm from Lanarkshire, Scotland, so I took an opportunity to go back home to visit a place called New Lanark. This was Robert Owen's first experiment in a socialist utopian society, right next to where I was born and brought up. It's a quaint place and sits in a beautiful valley on the Falls of Clyde. Its charm is deceptive. Behind it lies the dangerous philosophy the atheist and socialist Robert Owen would soon import to the United States. Usually everything that comes to America from Scotland is brilliant. Well, in this case, Scottish Enlightenment ideas started to impact America.
Okay, so Robert Owen, it really is nice there. go to Scotland, going to New Lanark's worthwhile. This is New Harmony, it's kind of interesting there too. But the Falls of Clyde, you know, if you can walk up along past that area to an area called the Falls of Clyde and watch the salmon leap up the waterfalls. It's a really beautiful area. The architecture is interesting. Although it's called New Lanark, it's still very old because it's from the 1800s, and it has the cobblestone streets and the red phone boxes. And it's been used in movies quite a lot of times when the BBC want to film one of their new, you know, other docudrama type things. That's they use New Lanark because it's really nice. And so we used to go there. We used to go there as children. When I was in the public schools, they would take all the kids to New Lanark. And, you know, of course, it's all great. And Robert Owen was a genius, according to, you know, the Tourist Board of Scotland, because they saw him. They saw him in the light as the same way they see Horace Mann and Dewey as sort of humanitarians. And so they have this humanitarian angle that these guys were coming in and fixing this problem of education and, you know, caring for people. And to some extent, you can, you know, although they have these big worldview issues, I'm sure they had to some extent some good intentions with what they were doing. But the issue involved was their priority of taking children away from their parents. And he wanted to do it at a very young age. In fact, the quote here is, you know, we will receive your children at an early age, almost as soon as they can walk. So it's pretty young toddlers. And it says, mothers and families, you will have less care and anxiety about them, while the children will be prevented from acquiring any bad habits. That bad habits is an interesting phrase. And then he goes on to say, believe me, my friends, you're very deficient with regard to the best modes of training your children. Now, well, that's the philosophy right now of the Department of Education in America. That's where this is coming from. This is the very early beginnings of that conceit where these individuals said, we will be better at what you can do at home, and if you trust us, we'll make sure they don't have any bad habits. Of course, what are the bad habits? What are the bad habits right now in the public schools? Bad habits are Christian ideas, you know, prejudice. You know, that's the big thing we see the Department of Education trying to deal with. You know, look at these, you get these Christian kids coming in. We've heard of a story where in a classroom, and a teacher told me this story, where they had a classroom, public school, where they made all the kids who were against homosexual marriage line up on one side, and all of the kids who were for homosexual marriage stand up on the other side. So you had one or two kids over here against homosexual marriage, and of course, they were held as an example of prejudice. So, you know, foolish parents who send their kids into that kind of environment, you know, that's the worst thing. But that's the tactic. Of course, is very much a covert tactic in the public school system. They don't tell you about this, but this is going all the time in the public schools in terms of ideology. It might be environmentalism or other isms like feminism, but certainly that big agenda, the homosexual agenda, is a big part of that. So these bad habits, you know, they're so focused on these other things. That's what they think bad habits are. And that was Robert Owen's philosophy. He wanted to take the kids away. The parents, the bad habits the parents had were, and this is their philosophy, is that they believed we can't change culture until we fix this problem of this ideology, which was this Christian ideology. They felt that was and this was the evolutionary thinking at the time. When the evolutionary thinking came along, they thought, this is it. We have the opportunity for significant progress. And that was because it was coming up through the Industrial Revolution. They had this optimism, kind of like we have today, with where we kind of marry humanism with technology, even though there's no reason to do that. So we're like computers and, you know, all this information and all the rest of it. Well, that's the computers are a blessing, but let's not use that as pridefully, as they did with the Industrial Revolution, to say this is a new world, we're going to create this new world. And so we're trying to break from the past in the past was obviously the Christian ideology that was there in Scotland, prevalent. So, you know, the model of a home where the parents raised and disciplined the children. That was not Robert Owen's plan at all. Horace Mann came along. He was a Unitarian, although at the time Unitarianism wasn't seen as heretical as as it obviously is. The Unitarians, they didn't believe in the Trinity. That really affects them when it comes down to the reality of Christ and who he is. If you don't believe in the deity of Christ, then you're going to be off pretty much in almost everything in the Bible, especially the idea of, you know, what is the purpose of all of this? You know, the usual, if you're not, if Christ isn't center, then what happens? Well, man becomes central. So because they didn't believe that Christ was on the throne reigning as we would believe and in control of our world and culture, who is in control of culture? Well, they put man firmly in that position. And because of that, that was the angle of the Unitarians, and it led towards this very humanistic change that fitted very much with Robert Owen's atheistic philosophy. The two went hand in hand, the Unitarians and the atheists. And then I believe the Christians were duped with all of this, and the Protestants, a lot of them were duped into it because of their fear of the Roman Catholic influence and culture. And Jeff Botkin talks about that in our film. He studied the Prussian schools, which he couldn't have found a worse example for the way to do school. And they had centralized compulsory state-funded education, which is the model that we have today. And so, you know, the kind of half joke in our film is, you know, it's not public schools. You're trying to fix the public schools. Well, it's not even American. You know, the very foundation of American compulsory education is not Christian or American. So that lots of people are trying to fix the public schools. I meet them all the time. And they have a real, you know, a heartfelt desire to improve and help with all of the issues. They're all, you know, pro-life creationist people. And, you know, just like me, they're very like me, but I think they have a really bad tactic. And that's because they're laboring in vain to build a building that the Lord has not been the foundation of. And so they're utterly wasting their time in it. On the best side of it, they're wasting their time. On the worst side of it, they're using it for political leverage, for their own power. And that's true of a lot of Republican parties, that the education is used by both sides, whether it's the charter schools or whether it's the left trying to, you know, change society and all the rest of it. It's a political football. Our film is not popular in political spheres because we have an argument of separation that just says, forget what the public schools are doing and separate yourself. Horace Mann believed in the parenthood of the state, and we have a quote from him, maybe I think later that talks about that. He rejected the doctrine of original sin. This is all the consequence of the unbelief in his anti-Trinitarian view. He viewed natural law as the governing factor in education, so opposed the sovereignty of the parents in discipline and instruction. So deep change in the philosophy of what education means. And this is what we're saying when we're saying, you know, these people, at the very essence of understand or being educators, because there's lots of stuff. If you read educational theory, have someone here who actually studied that at, you know, university level, and it's a real mess. It's very complicated and difficult. Educational theory is very deep, and these guys, if you're a Christian going into that, if you're not aware, you're going to be duped into a lot of philosophies. But it really comes down to, who is man? What is he to learn? What is the nature of that information? Where does that information come from? And if you don't believe in the supremacy of Scripture, you're going to quickly go down the line of natural law. Of course, natural law is, you know, flexible and is, you know, changes and is unreliable for things that we would say is written in Scripture that we need to follow. He was a utopian, and that was certainly much the flavor of the day as it is today in many spheres, and they believed in the education would bring a form of salvation. And there's the quote. We who are engaged in the sacred cause of education are entitled to look upon all parents as having giving hostages to our cause. This was the utopian vision. And the fact that he says it was sacred is very much the kind of flavor of what it was, you know, a counter church. It was another form of spiritual practice. course, Karl Marx has got to be connected to all this, and you know, the 10th plank, along with all the other planks, have been adopted by the American political system. And he said, we must abolish the family. We must destroy the most hallowed of relations. We must replace home education with social. And so Marx is speaking to that world which would have known home education. You know, this is the surprise. In America, it's at least 60s, 70s, and 80s, 90s, home education has changed now, and I'm thankful for the prominent homeschoolers. You know, the biggest blessing to the homeschooling movement is having a family like Duggars being on television, where people are introduced to the idea of homeschoolers, and they might not like the Duggars or whatever, but I think they're a great example, and we need more of that. And we are seeing more of that as other people, you know, make the choice of homeschooling, and they're being advocates for it. But back in the day, this was the ideology, or the homeschooling is such an unusual thing. But in the 1800s, someone like Karl Marx would have been very aware that the home education would have been there, and his goal was to take that home education away and replace it with social education, collectivist education. And along comes G. Stanley Hall. I didn't know anything really about G. Stanley Hall until I started to look into him, but he's very influential. I brought Freud over from to the USA, and he was a Darwinian. He believed in the recapitulation theory. I think it's ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny, and he believed in that philosophy. And but you know, because evolution, it was this new exciting idea. Of course, academics loved it because it, you know, got rid of the idea of the sovereignty of God. And so, from that perspective, they started to run with it, and they ran all over the place with the idea of Darwinian evolution, to the point that they started doing really foolish things and started talking about education, applying it to education in a way that didn't really make sense, you know, and Doug Phillips talks about that. I might have a clip of that. And their view, because they had a changing view of man, they started to apply this. So they started to apply the evolutionary model in the form of age segregation, which didn't make any sense, and it comes down to it. It's kind of debunked even from the other side. But that was G. Stanley Hall for you, and had a huge influence. I think I've got a little clip about that.
Economy, as we did have for quite a long, long time, you need young people who can do anything and everything. We're self-reliant, and don't say, oh, Daddy, the plow broke. You know, you look at it, and you say, oh, that's what went wrong, I'll fix it. But we don't have that kind of economy. We have a mass production economy.
The Industrial Revolution required a growing number of obedient factory workers. The schools became the training ground for those workers. For the average American public school child, things were about to get much worse. Thanks to a man by the name of G. Stanley Hall, a Harvard psychologist who in 1889 became the first president of Clark University.
G. Stanley Hall, a child development theorist, who took Darwin's theory of evolution and applied it to the development of children. See, G. Stanley Hall said, well, you know, if it's true that there is this sort of evolutionary process which transcends every aspect of life, why not view training that way? So, you know, let's just say, for example, we've got children that are all at different stages of evolution. So to speak, the Australopithecine stage and the Ramapithecus stage and the Neanderthal stage. Well, by all means, keep the Neanderthals away from the Australopithecine, because we need everybody in their own little groups, and thus developed a brand new form of education. Age-segregated, peer-based, grade-based education, not based on the quality of the student, not based on his intelligence or where he was, that was once true in the one-room schoolhouse, but based on this evolutionary model, which would be part of the new public school system.
So the interesting thing about G. Stanley Hall is he believed in, and what's very relevant to today, philosophy, which is child-centered education. That always sounds nice, doesn't it? And it makes, you know, well, of course our education is child-centered, but the philosophy behind that is that childhood was a perfection and adulthood was the fall from that that perfection, which is actually the reverse. The Christian view is that children are brought to maturity. That's maturity is the standard for our created order. And so childishness and immaturity, of course, is the spirit of the age, where we have men playing video games all the time into their 30s and remaining unmarried and all the rest of it. this child-centered, play-oriented form of education has been a damaging philosophy and still exists today and is popular. It believed that our animal past should be the source of our knowledge, which, of course, is ridiculous looking at animals and, of course, ethically and morally and all the rest of it. That's not the way to go. And then part of that is trusting instinct over reason, because they don't believe that reason, that's, you know, as we find, which is always, you know, the interesting aspect, the more atheistic and unbelieving you are, the further you are away from the belief in absolute truth. And by consequence of that, irrationality becomes... Irrationality partnered with whim and instinct tend to dictate a lot of that person's characteristics, lives, and choices. And so this was the spontaneity, permissiveness, and play emphasis over book learning, which is still popular in our classrooms today. And yet believed in character as a product of conditioning. So it was the reverse of the Christian belief, is that out of the heart proceeds evil thoughts. So, of course, we have to mention Freud. And Freud's been debunked 1,000 times over. Most people aren't Freudians now because of his ridiculousness of his ideas. I mean, if you actually look into Freud, and I've only done a little bit, it's so bizarre in that you can't see where he possibly got it from. And the reason that it's bizarre is he's looking at evolution and as a starting point. He was also mixed up in the occult and drug abuse himself personally. And so you ended up with a really radically weird philosophy and practice, even although it became the standard for 100 years for psychotherapy. He said religion can now be set aside in favor of reason and science. So that was Sigmund Freud. And John Dewey, of course, you know, we've got John Dewey highs all over the place, and we've got Horace Mann elementary schools, and that's just the way that we idolize these people. They really are, you know, highly respected. Of course, Dewey signed the Humanist Manifesto, and he said you can't make socialists out of individualists. Children who know how to think for themselves spoil the harmony of the collective society which is coming, where everyone is interdependent. And so the very clear idea of what socialist education is about, to change America and change people into a collectivist. Of course, collectivism involves people being controlled from the top down, which is exactly what we have in our culture today, where we talk to people and they're automatons ideologically, because they've only ever heard one message, and that message is this controlled message that comes from the state. And so that's what we're dealing with, and John Dewey is the guy behind it. Clarence Darrow is another good atheist. He's on the bus too. He believed, and this is a reverse of the scripture, he said, the fear of God is not the beginning of wisdom. The fear of God is the death of wisdom. Skepticism and doubt lead to study and investigation, and investigation is the beginning of wisdom. So... And here's a little clip about...
Sadly, on the horizon is an event that would guarantee Darwin a permanent seat on the school bus in the little town of Dayton, Tennessee.
The whole thing was engineered to develop publicity for Dayton. They were looking for something to attract attention, draw business to the community. And when they saw the ACLU wanted to test the law, right, let's try it.
Tom Davis is the director of public information at Bryan College.
Got together at Robinson's drugstore, and they had arranged for the school superintendent and the principal of the high school, who was also the biology teacher, and some lawyers, and a magistrate in case anything got out of hand, of course. But the principal, Mr. Ferguson, said, I don't think I want to do this. So then they had to find a teacher and settled on Mr. Scopes. This is the judge and his family, Darrow, Scopes, Neil, Brian arriving. H.L. Mencken called this the monkey trial. And so somebody had to bring a monkey, a chimpanzee here. We are in the circuit courtroom of the Ray County Courthouse in Dayton, Tennessee. In this courtroom in 1925, John Scopes was tried for violating a state law that made it illegal for any teacher that taught any theory that contradicts the biblical account of human creation, and to teach instead that man is descended from a lower order of animals.
Okay, so What people don't realize about those videos, that pose of me, is that they're all fake because we only have one camera. So what we do is we film the other person, and then we go over the other side, and I make these reaction shots of me nodding or shaking my head. So I always laugh when I see them because we actually have two cameras now that we use, so we don't do that as much. But at that time, we would do all my fake reaction shots where I'd laugh and look sad and serious sometimes. So, but Clarence Darrow, another avowed enemy of Christianity and participating here in this Scopes trial, although he was on the other side, losing side, technically won because it was a boost for the other side because he was exposing, to some extent, the hypocrisy of Christians who compromised on their position in the book of Genesis, which I think was true of the Christians that were there. I think they didn't make as good a case. They would have made a much better case if they were Ken Ham or one of our guys. So they kind of dropped the ball. But the issue there is, why are we debating this? Well, the Christians had already lost because they surrendered their children to the state and they were subject to a trial. And this is the folly of all that goes on with the Christians in Texas today as we try and get stickers on textbooks saying evolution might be a theory. And it's the same thing. We've already lost. We're already losing the fight when we're in the courts battling over little things like that. So the Christians there, they should have learned a lesson, and they didn't. So that's the significance. It's a battle of worldviews. That was the issue there. It's interesting that in healthcare we're talking about, this is a sort of a tangent, but in healthcare we're talking about this battle of philosophies that are there. So collectivism can only work under one ideology. When you've got collectivism under opposing ideologies, which you have in education, where you have the Christians don't want this, and the unbelievers over here don't want this, and the Christians want one thing, and the unbelievers want one thing, and there's no resolution, there's no way you can have common ground. The same is true in healthcare. We go in Texas, we've been up to the Capitol where all the pro-life stuff was, and they hate us. This other crowd over there, they're screaming for abortion rights, hate us, and we're standing there arguing for the protection. Where's the common ground? It's impossible to find that common ground, but ironically, they want us to pay for their health care, including their abortions. And even if you're not a believer, you think you're going to have the rationality to say that's not fair because these people, they hate us. They're, shouting at us and yelling in our cameras when we're filming them, swearing and all the rest of it. But then on the other hand, they want us to pay for their health care. And that's just the same thing with the government school system. I think anyone who's rational will understand that that's ridiculous, this is the thing. It made the Christians look bad, which they kind of deserved in a way because they were inconsistent and had failed in their duty to be out of that system. I mean, I'm not judging them. I'm maybe judging them a bit harshly because we are where we are now in hindsight, looking back at that. So back in the 1800s, there was a couple of people. A. Hodge is always interesting, and he was at Princeton and professor of systematic theology or something like that. He's pretty high up there and well-known theologian, reformed theologian. But he saw it, and he said, a comprehensive and centralized system of national education separated from religion, as is now commonly proposed, will prove the most appalling enginery for the propagation of anti-Christian and atheistic unbelief, which the sin rent world has ever seen. So he's not mincing his words. He's saying, uses the term anti-Christian, and that's the philosophy that it is, very clearly, and he saw it. And so Dabney says something very similar. And in fact, he says here, any training which attempts to be non-Christian is anti-Christian. God is the rightful supreme master and owner of all reasonable creatures, and their neatest and highest duties are to him. Hence, to train a soul away from him is robbery of God. He is not indeed committed to the state the duty of leading souls to him as its appropriate task. This is committed to the family and to his church. So you're getting a double lesson there from Dabney, and Dabney's great, and here he's talking about, he's using a presuppositional apologetical method here, talking about the supremacy of the crown rights of Christ, and that if you're, you know, what's the purpose of education? What's the philosophy of education, teleology of education? It is to glorify Christ. And that's the first premise that we begin with, which is contrary to all other educational philosophies. Then goes on to talk about the issue of sphere sovereignty, because Dabney believed in the law of God and knew in those separations of responsibilities and duties and the problem of usurping any other responsibility from within those spheres. So, that, you know, the church isn't there for capital punishment, and neither is the family. So the state has responsibility to punish evildoers. The family has responsibility that's separate from the church. And when you muddle up those leadership and that authority, you end up with a mess. The interesting thing there is he says, it's not intended or committed to state the duty of leading souls to him as its appropriate task. And some of their arguments are very interesting because they would give an argument, and Machen gave this argument as well when he talked about the public schools, and they argued that it's wrong to have these teachers read the Bible and teach on the Bible, which is the reverse of the Christians today who are trying to get Bible into schools, and there's people all over the place. Let's get the Bible back into the schools. These guys would have opposed that for the reason of sphere sovereignty. They say that the teachers in the state are not to be religious teachers. They're not allowed to be, you know, required to teach from the Word of God because they're never going to be good at it. You know, and the problem is if you mishandle the Word of God, that can be worse than anything else. So forcing a public school teacher to pray or read the Bible in front of the class is actually a pretty terrible idea because you know how it'll be used. They'll read the Word of God and they'll say whatever they want and they'll damage. You know, bad teaching is one of the biggest fears. No teaching is better in that circumstance, you know. One of the whistleblowers that we interviewed who's really important in all of this, so we're sort of getting into here's what you need to look at. John Taylor Gatto is one of our favorite guys, and he looked into this a whole history. He goes even further. We don't cover really anything in the 1900s. We really wanted to do the 1800s, and we go through the 1900s. There's some stuff we mentioned. It had to be very brief, but John Taylor Gatto goes into a bigger picture. There's the famous quote from our film where he says, you know, it's wonder how many centuries we have to see this playing out in front of our eyes before we say something crazy is going on here. And that's really it. And he says at the end there, you know, it's a mad idea, this idea of giving your kid to other professionals. And, you know, I was joking at one of the other seminars that we'd never do this with our money. We'd never hand our money to, and we're talking about school shootings. And the circumstance that we have with these entrusting our most precious things that we will ever have, which are our children, to these schools who are obviously negligent in the way that they're protecting these children. We would never do that with our money. If we had money that we would never hand it to a bank that didn't protect it, keep it away from theft. But that's, you know, I think that's a relevant analogy. So
here's I've got a John Kelly battle.
I think the year was 1989. It's New York City Teacher of the Year. My kids had written this incredible record, really incredible. You know, which I'm very little to do it. And I just took my boot off the back of their neck and sort of imitated the best homeschoolers, at least in my opinion. So in my acceptance speech, which has been reprinted about 1,700 times all over the world, I tried to tell the audience who didn't want to hear it exactly what it was that I was teaching. It had nothing to do with English. It had a lot to do with certain attitudes.
What was the reaction?
The reaction was dead silence. Nobody said anything. Nobody clapped, nobody booed. Interesting reaction.
John Gatto teaches eighth graders. Though he's been teaching in New York City schools for 26 years, he disdains grades, tests, and conventional ways of teaching. He'd rather not teach in the classroom, but the school requires him to 4 days a week.
Confining people in rooms and monitoring every minute of their lives in those rooms couldn't possibly fit into any definition of education that's come from any corner of the world. None. So let's very quickly review what these
I don't teach the kids that education's bad. I say that schooling's bad.
We spent a long time studying the great people who'd never gone to school, and the great Americans who had never gone to school. George Washington had 2 years, period. He had no more time to waste. Thomas Jefferson had zero. They had no schooling. They had great educations because they were talking to real people from the time they were small. They were being given, Jefferson was in charge of a 2,500 acre plantation with 250 employees when he was 12 years old.
John Tillerdow contrasted the successful education of our founding fathers with what is happening in the schools today.
Okay, so it's a good library, isn't it? The big book recommendation I have is The Messianic Character of American Education. So all that we've been talking about, all this stuff, you know, so it's a book that we made the movie of. This is it. Not even sort of scratching the surface of the content of The Messianic Character. This is a great book. It was written in 65, so it's in way before all of this stuff. This is older than I am. This is a great book. And so you've got this revolutionary book, and he just goes through it chapter by chapter, which is like Kevin's book as well, where he just goes through these people, because it really is about people. That's what we have to understand about history. We don't believe these things are random. Start to look into the philosophy of the individuals and these characters of the past. We start to see how we start to understand history much better. And so, reading The Messianic Character, he goes into many characters more than we did. So you can come to our booth. We have the DVDs there. Also, there are other films that we talk about. So Shaky Town through to Indoctrination, with 6 films that we've worked on right now. And we have the DVD and the Indoctrination DVD book as well. So that's the end of my talk. Does anyone have any questions? I can take personal questions if you want to come up after. And you don't want to ask from the audience. Yes? Actually, not a lot. So, I mean, I'm obviously against them in terms of, but I haven't looked into the detail of the philosophy, and I think that's the, I think they can often be better, obviously, than public schools. I think degrees, they're not operating on a Christian philosophy, which is the biggest problem I'll ever have, and that's the key to it. And a lot of parents are looking for alternatives, and Montessori is one of those ones in Texas that's still often state-funded, and it seemed like a more holistic and improved version of the public schools. I just severely doubt that is the case. I know the teachers that go to the ones that are any different than the teachers in the public schools. They transition over to Montessori schools, so, there's not going to be a difference in terms of what you're getting. There might be differences in terms of type of curriculum, how the kids structure their day, and all those superficial things. Do you know anything about it?
I think the Montessori is based on the structure of the children direct their own
life. Oh, yeah.
When they get interested in math, they do math. When they get interested in this, and certainly all the younger grades are very centered. Which, like you said, it's, we can do whatever, because we're empty when we start. well, just pull over to whatever you want.
Yeah, that's important. I haven't looked into it. I think you're right, though. I think that's part of the following criticism. Obviously, as homeschoolers, we offer a huge amount of flexibility in terms of what the kids do and the schedule. We were just talking about that before everyone came in. I was talking about sleep deprivation and the impact on the lives of children in the public schools, and it's worse for the kids that are getting bussed in. So, it's a great idea of equal rights, bussing children in from other districts has harmed the lives, significantly educational ability of those that are getting bussed because they're sleep deprived, they're not sleeping enough, they're showing up at school, and it's an awful circumstance to their health as well. And this is what the public schools mean. Another unintended consequence of it. We don't like charter schools, homeschool at private school or public school at home with some curriculum, and I think it's all just a huge mistake. And personal independence is going to be, try and make it look like there's a lot of people in the room when you take your photograph. Okay, so get low. and I'll do an animated voice. So, okay, we're done. Thank you very much.
Well, she'll have to go to the academy first.
I'm a horrible boss, though. People say, you know, I try and say thank you all the time, but, you know, I'm always like, when I'm in work mode, I think I just, you know, get it done.
Yeah, no, that's true. No, this is like her big push mom. I told her I wanted to go to the academy. See, I have to.
I talked to the guys mainly.
Right.
That sort of found that what we've seen is the young women are good at writing or good at different little things, you know.
Yes, yes. Well, she's only just about to turn 16.
Okay.
So she's still getting interested. She has a lot of interest in general film, in documentaries, but also in trying to provide story fiction things that are, like you said, there's a lot of the Christian young people doing this, you know, the big danger thing, you know. That was a really interesting take. I really hadn't thought about it once you said it. I went, oh, they really are, you know, all these sword fights and all these things. You know,
it's fine. They want drama, but my opinion is they're doing something that can only do that. And, you know, so they write a story where, okay, you die in this scene. You know, the best actor in the world can't pull off a dramatic death scene for you. They go, ugh! You know, yeah.
Oh, no.
And then they're doing bad sword fights filmed in the wrong way. Yeah. Those things are really hard to do.
Well,
you know,
and there's a lot of skill involved in it that, you know, people study for years to do.
So what they can do is simple things and, like, see documentaries.
I loved what you said about doing your grandparents. And,
yeah,
you know,
like,
oh, wow.
I mean, if a story happens in your mind, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, we're close to you. You live in Belton.
Yeah.
So,
okay.
You know, I don't know if there'd be times when there's things in... And,
we have a little farm in Andy, which is a good farm.
Oh, yeah.
It's closer than Wakefield.
Yeah.
A little like where you're at.
That's great. Well, my husband was raised on a dairy farm.
Oh,
so the dairy is still there. His brother's running it now. We live right across the river from it, so we're
You sell...
Then we also
sell on Ashacres.
Yeah,
that's true. What's the name of it?
It's called Ashacres Dairy.
Ashacres.
Do you want the phone number? I don't have one of her cards.
Well, we don't buy. I'm going to ruin all your shots.
Oh, look at this. Sorry. What is that woman giving him out of her purse? I've got a piece of paper. I'll just write it down.
Okay.
But yeah, they do, and they have a permit and everything, you know. So it's all permitted and appropriate.
Yeah. Well, we buy, you know, high tech. I think we get from Milk King. You know who they are.
I don't think that is.
They're pretty small operations.
And this couple, they hold schools as well.
Yeah, but we were out in Andy, like,
Yeah.
It's good to know there's other people nearby.
Yeah.
You know, it's, you know, Central Texas is kind of that weird place, you know, so much churchianity and nonsense and Baylor people.
Oh, yeah, that's kind of
they're the worst.
Place, yeah.
You can go to Baylor, then.
Mr. Gannon,
thank you
for coming.
Oh, thank you.
Someone told me that you were doing a video on Obamacare.
Right, yes, I am.
Okay, when will that be able to come out?
Probably end of January.
Okay.
So it's called Wait Till It's Free.
Okay.
We're covering the whole issue, the Christian perspective of health care,
okay,
along with Obamacare.
Okay.
So Obamacare is just part of it. We believe it's just another bad idea and a series of bad ideas.
Right.
So I think
okay.
It's important for us to respond to it,
yeah,
and it has consequences, significant consequences. But we believe that the defund Obamacare is not the solution to our healthcare problems. It's not a bad idea to try and politically demolish it, but the problems are much deeper. And we oppose everything in the head, you know, like the, you know, licensing and drug prohibition, all the areas where the government's intruding into health and damage people's health as a result. You're making it hard and inaccessible and expensive.
Right. Well, that'd be good. I work for a U.S. congressman.
Yeah, who's that?
Congressman Steve Stockman.
Oh, I know Steve Stockman. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so, our district
office. You're in here right now?
I was going to see if it make sure it's slides work and everything.
Okay. Now, I'll come over here.
There's no rush.
Okay.
Are you having more than one?
Yes. Randy, Zachary will be, and I will both be discussing.
Okay, so we all need two mics, two lapel mics.
We're going to do the lapel mics.
Yes.
Okay, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Church in the north side of Austin.
Oh, he lives out of Austin.